We have four cases on the docket today. Our first case is appeal number 21-2175, Maddox v. McDonough. Mr. Carpenter, whenever you're ready, you can proceed.
May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter on behalf of Mr. Maddox. The issues before this court are quite different. The first issue deals with process. The VA currently operates under two adjudicatory procedures. The first is currently referred to as legacy, the former process. The second is the process known as the AMA, which is the new adjudicatory process. The question before this court today is whether or not in the transition from one to the other, the obligations under the AMA apply. Specifically,
Mr.
in
Carpenter,
this...
Mr. Carpenter, can I just interrupt you? Is your argument just a little bit more narrow, which is whether Section 5104 applies in your case?
Absolutely.
To the board's decision.
To the board's decision.
Okay.
It is that small piece of the new adjudicatory process that we believe commences when there is a final legacy decision that has been issued, and that imposes, because the decision was made after the enactment of the AMA, to the board to provide the notice provided for by Congress in 5104B. Well, actually, A and B.
I understand the government to be contending that 5104 doesn't apply to any board decisions.
Correct.
Even those that clearly fall under the AMA, where even if the secretary's decision fell within that time period that it was under the AMA, nonetheless, the board's decision would not be subject to 5104. So what's your response to that argument?
Well, it's in direct conflict with the precedential opinions from the Veterans Court, but more importantly, it's in conflict with this court's precedent in Cummings. This court's decision in Cummings specifically said that this court recognized that the board was obligated to provide notice under the prior provisions of this statute, prior to its amendment. It seems illogical and unreasonable for the Congress to have added on these specific requirements and not intended them to apply. And the reason that that intent is clear is because Congress in both 5104A and in 7104, the board's jurisdictional statute, used the same opening phrase nearly verbatim, subject to decisions of the Secretary under 511. A board decision is a decision of the Secretary under 511. When you read the board's jurisdictional statute, this court has interpreted that statute to mean one review by the secretary of the decision of the secretary. So in a very somewhat schizophrenic way, Congress is referring to the board as both the board for its jurisdictional purposes and acting as the agent of the secretary in reviewing the decision of the secretaries as an administrative appellate.
And I guess your view would be that Section 512 supports that understanding, since Section 512 is what gives the Secretary the authority to delegate the decisions of the Secretary to the board or somebody else, and also says that the decisions of those delegated decisions shall be as if they were the decisions of the Secretary?
Absolutely are. Sorry?
You answer to Judge Stoll's question. Oh. You had more to say? Did you have more to say?
No. Okay. The way in which this court has viewed the board is that the board is acting as the agent of the secretary, making decisions under the mandatory language of 7104 to provide one review of the decision of the secretary.
And 7104 was what I wanted to make sure I understood your view on, because it does seem to distinguish between decisions of the secretary and decisions of the board. So how do you square that with your argument?
Well, unfortunately, it's one of those many squares that are not entirely square from Congress in the language that it uses, which is why I mentioned that it refers to one review of the secretary's decision by the secretary. So the by the secretary has to refer to the board itself. So the decision is, excuse me, the mandate of Congress is that the board, as a construct, shall be the appellate body which reviews upon perfection of an appeal under the legacy system a decision by the secretary.
Is there a statutory definition of what is a legacy claim?
No, there is not, Your Honor. This is essentially what we were left with when Congress in 2017 enacted the AMA and then delayed its implementation until February 2019. And it is that February 2019 date that becomes the demarcation for the transition from legacy to the AMA. The question here is, when does a legacy decision end?
Well, and I may have this wrong, but in that the note to Section 101, in Section 6, there's definitions, and there seems to be a definition there of legacy claims, and it says the legacy claim means a claim for which the notice of a decision under Section 5104 was provided by the secretary before the date set forth in Section 2F. Is that applicable here?
Well, it is to the extent that that's what defines Mr. Maddox's appeal to the board as a legacy appeal. The question is, when that legacy appeal ends with a final decision from the board under the AMA, because this decision was decided after February 19, 2019, what is the board's obligation from a notice perspective? I would suggest that there are two separate notices. The first notice is the one that keeps it in legacy until it's finished. The second notice is at the end. And the problem is Congress simply provided no guidance as to how we deal with that transition.
One of the concerns I had was in the same note that Judge Stark was referring to, there's that Section 5, Treatment of Legacy Claims, and there it refers to a statement of the case.
Yes.
It says, upon the issuance to a claimant of a statement of the case occurring on or after the applicability of the date specified in paragraph 1. Well, you know, the statement of the case isn't coming from the board. The statement of the case is coming from the RO.
Right. And the reference to statement of the case is relevant because Congress made specific opt-in provisions for veterans or claimants who have their claims or appeals in the legacy system to when they receive the statement of the case to opt in, or coming back from the board when they receive a supplemental statement of the case where the denial is continued in whole or in part. And that allows the case to either stay in legacy and be completed in legacy, or gives the veteran the option to opt in.
Well, what about, I think the government relies on this very provision to suggest that this note shows that Section 5104, when it's referring to a decision of the secretary, is only referring to the RO's decision, because this, you know, is talking about a statement of the case. How do you respond to that?
They're absolutely correct. That refers only to the decision of the secretary in the issuance of a statement of the case or a supplemental statement of the case. That notice has already been provided under the former provisions. This case is about when the legacy appeal ends, and it must end. There must be some finality to the legacy system. And that happened here in Mr. Maddox's case at the time in which Mr. Maddox was confronted with a final board decision after the AMA, which then gave him two options. He could either appeal to court, as he was forced to do, because he didn't have the notice under 5104B to inform him about filing a supplemental claim before the agency. And there's no question that the VA provides in its own regulations that after a final board decision coming from legacy, that the veteran is entitled then to go back within 1 year and file a supplemental claim.
What about the argument the government makes? They argue that because Section 7104 already specified what the board's decision has to require, that supports the interpretation of 5104 as not applying to board decisions.
It simply ignores the opening phrase in both 5104A and 7104A, subject to the decisions of the secretary under 511. The decision of the board, as has been interpreted by this court, is a decision of the secretary under 511. If it's a decision of the secretary under 511, then it is necessary for the 5104B notice to be provided. I see I'm almost completely out of the time before I'm into my rebuttal, but I would very much like to get to the second issue, which is 5107B. 5107B, we believe, has been clearly defined by the Veterans Court as a standard of proof. And it either is the only standard of proof in the VA adjudicatory system, or it's not. There is no role or function for the preponderance of evidence standard of proof. There equally can be no question that preponderance of evidence is a standard of proof, and that when the VA or the board in this case insinuates that into this process, it undermines the clear intent of Congress to provide a unique and special standard of proof as was described in Gilbert. This is not an issue.
Do you dispute that the VA is acting as a fact finder?
Actually, I do, Your Honor, because I do not believe the role is to be a fact finder in the adversarial context, that they are not sitting as triers of fact.
The government says your position essentially is all you would have them do is count up the number of pieces of evidence. You deny that, but what would you let them do under your
reading? Well, but the problem with trivializing that, Your Honor, is that this is about the only standard of proof that's been provided by Congress.
Okay, but I just want to understand what it is you think the VA is allowed to do in their role as whatever we're going to call them.
They are required under their duty to assist to obtain pertinent evidence to substantiate the claim. Under their 3.104A statement of policy, they are to develop that evidence to determine every benefit that can be awarded under law. Then they are to apply the focus of that or analysis of that evidence under the positive evidence or the negative evidence. Congress only gave them two options. Evidence that they develop is either positive, which must favor the grant, or negative, which is evidence which must undermine
the
grant.
So they can label each piece of evidence positive or negative, and then they just count up how much.
No, then they must determine in the language provided by Congress whether or not that evidence is or is not in approximate balance. And the flaw here is when you cross the line and misuse a concept like preponderance of evidence, which is to say, as they did in this decision, that we need not apply the benefit of the doubt. There was no intention on Congress to not apply the benefit of the doubt. This process is the benefit of the doubt is to be awarded when the evidence is in approximate balance. And that's the information that claimants are entitled to when they get their decision from the board.
Mr. Carver, how is the determination made as to whether evidence is in approximate balance? Say we have item A, which is for the veteran, item B, which is against the veteran. There's two items, but how do we determine whether they're in approximate balance?
Well, Your Honor, to be perfectly candid, there is no instruction from Congress as to how one does that. The only instruction from Congress is in 5107 that on any matter that is material to a determination in a case, so it can be as to an issue or as to the ultimate grant, the benefit of the doubt shall be afforded by the Secretary when there is an approximate balance. So the adjudicatory responsibility is not to be the trier of fact, but to be the determiner of whether or not...
But can it fairly be said there's an approximate balance if one of the pieces of evidence is not at all credible, whoever it's for mm-hmm. or against, and the other piece is very credible? So you have two pieces of evidence, but one is very strong and one is very weak. Is that an approximate balance?
No, Your Honor, that's not. And that's not what 5107 is addressing. In that circumstance, if the evidence is entirely on the side of favorable, or as this court said in
Lynch,
that it is persuasive to one side or the other, then that's the end of the matter. The question under 5107 or the standard of proof is for those cases that fall in the massive middle, where the evidence is not clear and the evidence has to be in, it doesn't have to be in exactly approximate balance, as this court indicated, but you must use that standard of proof. The VA must use that standard of proof. And when they don't, as they didn't here, that's a clear error of law. I'm sorry, I'm almost completely through my rebuttal time.
Well, we asked her a lot of questions. We'll give you some more time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the government.
May it please the court. I guess I will address the issue regarding the notice required under the AMA first. Our view of the law is that those AMA provisions, those notice provisions in the statute, do not apply to Mr. Maddox's legacy appeal. We have several reasons for that view, and we believe the Veterans Court got it right. Number one, we believe that Mr. Maddox's view of that notice provision is not supported under the text of the statute. We have applicability provisions enunciated in Section 2X of the AMA. We believe those speak to the instances in which the notice provisions would apply to a legacy claim. Mr. Maddox's claim does constitute a legacy claim, so we think Section 2X should be decisive on that question. The second problem we have with Mr. Maddox's view is that it would create broad inconsistencies throughout Title 38. Namely,
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. What about, how should we read the language in the case of a decision by the Secretary under Section 511 of this title? That's Section 5104. That language is very broad. And of course, Section 512 says that the Secretary can delegate the decision making to the board.
Right.
But that decisions by the board would be viewed as if decided by the Secretary. So why isn't this broad language, decision by the Secretary under Section 511, where some of that decision authority has been given to the board, why isn't this broad language covering the board's decisions?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, and Section 512 is not something that I had thought of, but I will point the court to, for example, Title 38, Section 7104, because I do think to the extent there is any concern about, you know, what constitutes a decision of the Secretary, it's helpful to look at other parts of Title 38 and see how the term or the phrase, the statutory phrase, decision by the Secretary, has been used throughout the rest of the applicable statutes under Title 38. For example, 7104, we see that how that statute is written, and this is subpart A, it defines a Section 511A decision by the Secretary as subject to one review on appeal to the Secretary. And then it creates a distinction. It says final decisions on such appeals shall be made by the board. So we think that statutory language seems to create an understanding that decision by the Secretary is supposed to be viewed as something different than a decision by the board. But even if
you also argue that 7104 is somewhat overlapping and 7104B or D, excuse me, somewhat overlaps with the notice provisions of 5104?
I do think it sort of does overlap, but I think the mere fact that a separate statute exists regarding what notice provisions are required to be provided by the board should indicate that that notice provision applies to the board and that there is a separate statute, 5104, be in this case that would apply to the regional office in this case. Because to the extent those two statutes exist and are meant to apply to the same entities, they would be duplicative. And so it would create superfluity throughout the statute. So we think it's best read separately. A couple other things that I think might be helpful is Section 5103A, which is part of the AMA, refers to the 5104 provision that we're talking about in this case. And it specifically refers to 5104 notices as decisions or notices of decision by the agency of original jurisdiction. And so, Judge.
Where is that? You said 5103, which part?
A subpart E, I believe. And so, again, we think that when it says it refers to 5104 decisions, and it also uses language notices of agency of original jurisdiction. That phrase, and this goes to your question, Judge Stark, that phrase agency of original jurisdiction actually is defined in the AMA. It's definition 34. That provision was added into the statute with the promulgation of the AMA, And if the court were to turn to 19 CFR 20.3, that has been a regulatorily defined phrase. And if you look at the regulatory definition of agency of original jurisdiction, it specifically doesn't include the board. It says...
Yeah, I have a question, though, which is that to a certain extent, this could be argued against you. Because here, where they have to refer to notice for agency of original jurisdiction, isn't that more narrow than if... Clearly, Section 5104 only applied to the agency of original jurisdiction, then, you know, you wouldn't have to have this added language here in Section 5103AE, right?
Well, I guess our view is that when 5103A, subpart E, refers to Section 5104, that helps us inform, or that informs our understanding of what a 5104 notice decision is, or decision notice is.
I understand. That's one way to interpret it. But another way to interpret it, I would think, could be that, well, by having more limiting language in this part of the statute, it shows, in fact, that 5104 is broader than just this limited example. I'm just wondering if you have a response to it, either based on the phraseology in 5103A or anything else.
Not at the moment, Your Honor. I apologize. But I mean, I will point out this is just one instance where we're talking about what we're talking about is broad textual indicators throughout Title 38 that would seem to indicate that the way that we're supposed to interpret a decision by the Secretary is kind of something different than a decision by the board. And the last thing I'd point to again is what I mentioned earlier, Section 7104D through subpart E, which provides its own notice provisions that apply to the board. So the mere fact that a separate notice provision applies when it comes to decisions of the board would seem to indicate that the 5104 notice provisions wouldn't necessarily apply to decisions by the board. And if there's any question on even that statutory argument, the agency has defined it officially, and that's on 38 CFR section 3.2400A, where it does say that a decision by the Secretary refers to initial decisions by the VA. And that's consistent with all the broad textual indicators.
Could you give that site again?
Sure. It's 38 CFR, section 3.2400, subpart A. And so when that when it defines a decision by the Secretary, it refers to initial decisions of the VA. But we don't even think the court has to get to Chevron step two in this process. We think the text of the statute, the AMA as a whole, the applicability provisions, which pronounce when a legacy claim can transition into the AMA climate, should answer that question on its own. But to the extent there's doubt, there's also regulatory language that supports it. If there are no further questions on the notice provisions...
Do you make an argument that there's harmless error on this issue, if there was error, or is that not something you're pressing?
We have not made that argument, and we don't think the Veterans Court touched that issue either. We think it was treated as purely a statutory question. If it's okay with the court, I'll move on to the benefit of the doubt argument under 5107B. My friend on the other side seems to take the view... So part of my understanding of his view is that the VA or the board are precluded from doing fact-finding. It could be a little bit more nuanced than that. I'm not entirely sure. But I do think that if the court were to look at the Veterans Court statutes, which are 7261, the Veterans Court review statute says that the Veterans Court must review fact findings of the board for clear error. So the mere fact that that statute says that when the Veterans Court is reviewing a decision of the lower tribunal, it's reviewing findings of fact, would seem to indicate that Congress clearly contemplated that the VA and the board would do findings of fact in reaching their decisions. To the extent my friend is arguing about what the benefit of the doubt rule should mean, my friend's argument on the other side is that because there's preponderance of the evidence language in the Veterans Court decision, that's a basis for reversal. But I think any clear reading of the board's decision and the Veterans Court's decision shows that what the board actually found was that there wasn't an approximate balance of evidence. And so regardless of how one reads Lynch or Ortiz, it satisfies the benefit of the doubt standard regardless of the specific phraseology used. If there's any question on that, I would point the court to appendix page 16, where the court uses this is not an approximate balance evidence type case. And I would also point the court to appendix page 78, where you see the board weighing the evidence and the cases it cites, which says that, I don't want to characterize, so I'll actually just turn to it, page 78, where it says, As the examiner, and this is the middle of the page, the second long paragraph in the middle, as the examiner appears to have based the opinion on the veteran's inaccurate report of a 45, there might be a typo there, year history of psychiatric disability, the board finds the opinion to be of little probative value, clearly indicating the board saying, you know, this other contrary opinion just has very little probative weight. And then the case it cites is Monzingo, which is a Veterans Court decision, and in the parenthetical it says, if an opinion is based on an inaccurate factual premise, then it is correct to discount it entirely. So this really wasn't an instance where this was a close case. The board was finding that there wasn't an approximate balance of evidence. Regardless of whether there's preponderance of evidence language, I think it's beside the point, because we know why the board reached its decision. We also know why the Veterans Court then affirmed it. We respect the request that the court affirm the Veterans Court decision.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, you can have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am in a quandary, ethically. On Tuesday of last week, I argued this issue in a slightly different context before the Veterans Court. Before the Veterans Court, one of the members of the panel raised an amendment to the statute, which I had overlooked, there is a note of construction in that amendment to the provisions of 38 U.S.C. 7105, which adds an E subsection. And the E subsection specifically adds to the 7104 notice provisions that adds the language both decision and notice in the subparagraph E. And then the note of construction makes reference to whether or not that does or does not apply to board decisions. It's frankly confusing to me. I'm not quite sure what it means, but it is a relevant matter for this court's consideration, and I felt an ethical obligation to bring it to the attention of the court. On the government's response to the 5104B argument, it seems to me that the government simply overlooks the fact that at the end of the day, this is about what happens when legacy ends. We have no debate about what happens during legacy and that legacy is the controlling process. This board decision ended the legacy appeal. And then the veteran had the ability under the AMA to go forward. In order to go forward, he needed the notice under 5104. That's what Congress intended in creating the AMA, and that's what this court should find is the correct interpretation of 5104B.
So wouldn't any notice end the legacy and allow him to opt in to AMA if he wanted?
No. No, the only notice under legacy, once the appeal is in legacy and AMA is in applicable, the only way to get out of legacy is through a final decision or opting in with a statement of the case or a supplemental statement of the case. So there's only two ways to get into AMA. It's through the SSOC route or the end of it. And it's at the end that the veteran gets the opportunity to present a supplemental claim with new and relevant evidence to continue the processing of his appeal back before the agency on the basis of the new and relevant evidence. One final note before I sit down, I would direct the court's attention to Appendix 81, which is the 81 and 82, which is the very last paragraph of the board's decision. The board's decision expressly said, although the veteran is entitled to the benefit of the doubt where the evidence is in approximate balance, the benefit of the doubt doctrine is inapplicable, whereas here the preponderance of the evidence is against the claim. And we believe that that is introducing a standard of proof which does not apply under 5107, and this court must direct the Veterans Court that that misinterprets 5107 to permit the board to do just that. Now, as to exactly what the board's going to do in terms of balancing evidence and determining whether it's positive or negative, that's their challenge and that's their obligation. But it has been their obligation from the beginning. One final comment before I sit down. I would direct the court's attention to the predecessor VA regulation, which I believe is at 3.103F, which is the regulatory definition of benefit of the doubt. And in that regulatory definition of benefit of the doubt, the Secretary, before the advent of 5107B, describes just how much substantial doubt can exist and there be the right to the benefit of the doubt.
Mr. Carpenter, before you sit down, yes. would you mind submitting just a short letter about what you referred to? Just, you could just even include
I'd be happy
citation
to, yeah.
to what you referred to about sure. your previous CAVC argument?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Arnold.
Okay. The cases are submitted in the briefs. We thank counsel for their argument.